Well, hello and welcome to this totally unscripted episode of Intersections on the Spectrum podcast. If you haven't heard Doug's and my voice enough, we figured we would devote a whole episode to us kind of talking about different issues and kind of going deeper on some of the issues that some of our guests have spoken about. And so this is just going to be a super free-flowing, interesting conversation, we hope, on different subjects around disability and autism and everything else in life.
Yeah, and I don't know how well I'll do on this unscripted episode, Kelly, because usually I need to spend a lot of time planning for communication, but I think that I'd only do it in an environment where I felt safe. And so I think talking with you is always a pleasure of mine. And so I felt like, hey, let's give it a try and see where it leads us today.
And we can edit. So, and you're in control of the editing. Anything you want.
I'll edit all of my stumbling of the English language and we'll go from there. I guess, you know, maybe we could start off by kind of, like you said, we're going to dive deeper into some things that have been talked about. On the last episode with the wonderful Kayla Smith, you know, Kayla was talking about embracing new identities in our lives. And she said more recently, embracing her queer identity. So I know, like, so much we talk about embracing our autistic identity and learning later in life that we're autistic and all that. But I was wondering if learning you were autistic, learning about that identity, if that made you reflect on other identities in your life and reevaluate them, maybe reengage with other identities that maybe you were hesitant to?
I would say, like, for me, when it comes to different aspects of my identity, I've had, you know, throughout my life and just through my development, which is totally normal child development, things around my race, I think, was probably the earliest identity formation. How about that? I knew that when I was very young, you know, I had a Black father and a white mother, and I very much emulated my mother. And I remember there's often a lot of misunderstanding, I think, especially about mixed race people, that were confused. And I'm going to say that I was not confused about my race. There has never been an issue of confusion, but there was a misunderstanding in terms of how color, I think, in people develops, or melanin. And so I had said, well, when I grow up, like, obviously I'm a mixture of you and Dad. And when I grow up, I'm going to be white like you, Mom. Like, as if I could kind of choose. I figured, well, I'm female like you. I'm just going to be like you. So I'm going to be white like you, obviously. Makes sense for a four-year-old. And my mom was like, she's like, no, no. You know, she's like, you will always be Black. This is how you will always be. You will never be white. I always find it so interesting because that came from my white mother. You know, my mom, my white mom, was reinforcing my Black identity. So there was never any issue of her feeling like sad that I wasn't her color or that she, you know, that she wanted me to be a certain color. It was very much like, no, this is your pigment. This is who you are. You will always be Black. Yes, you're still part French Canadian, but you're always going to be Black. And so that was, like, I think, a very early cementation for me on my identity. So it was never any confusion around that. I find other people are more confused by my color or my identity than I am. I'm certainly not. So other people always kind of want to put me in some sort of category. And I'd say after that, like, more in my teen years, I thought I was bisexual because I didn't have a good concept or understanding of, I would say, gender issues in general, right? So, you know, I grew up in the 80s, so my concept of what was allowed or what was out there, what was applicable, was you were gay or lesbian or bi, and that was it. There were no other options. We didn't talk about gender, especially not in those early, for me at least. And that's even disregarding the fact that I grew up, like I said, I grew up in the 80s where we had Boy George and Annie Lennox, and I emulated these people and David Bowie, you know, looking very either androgynous or androgen. But anyway, I didn't have the term to describe my gender identity. And I felt like I was a mixture of male and female. And so the closest thing I could come to was sexual orientation was bisexual. So I figured I was bisexual because that was the only term I had. And, you know, that didn't stop me from experimenting and stuff and having sex with both men and women and all the exciting things that happen in teenager and in early 20s until I finally had the term for my actual gender. And I still think I am still kind of, I call myself gender agnostic, where I don't put a lot of importance on it. So I identified as androgen for quite a long time. Now I just say non-binary, or I say aut gender, which is kind of a mix of my weird autistic gender identity. I did change legally my designation of sex on my birth certificate and my legal documents here in Quebec. And it is a sex designation. It is not a gender designation, just to be clear. It has changed my birth certificate to be X, so as if I was born intersex or nobody knows. It changes my children's birth certificate that I become parent instead of mom or mother. And so it is considered a sex change, not a gender change in Quebec legally. So now I have X on most of my documents. I'm still working on some of them. It's a little slow. Anyway, I'm just rambling on about my own identity. I don't know, Doug, if you want to add some 2 cents in there too.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, like when I think of, and I've been thinking about this lately, for me, it's more religion because I'm Jewish. And for most of my life, I've felt uncomfortable, definitely to a certain extent because of it, because I don't feel like there's been a lot of, I don't feel like a lot of times it's inclusive. I feel like a lot of times when there's Jewish people of color that their experience is different than mine and maybe not in a positive way. And I've always felt like just like joining a temple, there's a capitalist aspect to it that has always made me feel uncomfortable. But I think learning about my autism in recent years is starting to make me reevaluate that and thinking, are there ways that I could re-engage with that aspect of my life? I don't know if there is realistically or not, but you know, recently talking to an autistic rabbi made me think about it. Like, is there a space for me as an autistic person in organized religion, and you know, in my specific religion? I don't know, but it's definitely made me kind of, as usual, I have more questions than answers.
Well, isn't that the I think part of all religion, I think, is always to be questioning. But I think I could understand like your sense of culture and community, and then having it separate and saying, well, do I really belong here? That's, yeah, there's no, wow, yeah, that's a deep question. You said we were going to go deep, but no, it's a deep question, right?
Yeah.
How you feel you connect, it doesn't, like, even if they say yes, as a community, we welcome you, it doesn't mean that you feel welcome.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's not just, and I've talked to religious leaders in different religions, talking with Lamar Hardwick a couple times, and, you know, an autistic pastor, and hearing, you know, he's written books on these subjects and could definitely articulate these things a lot better than I can. But yeah, what is our place in those things? Just like even from like sensory perspectives, like those things, you know, it's just really overwhelming. And sitting in these kind of crowded spaces, you know, it's just these tall ceilings, all types of things go on in these spaces. Just probably from an executive functioning thing, like just knowing the expectations when you go into these spaces a lot of times, is probably not clear enough for all of us. So yeah, I've thought a lot about this, and I don't know, you know, I think like it's probably maybe just a reflection of the rest of our society in terms of how spaces are built and how, like you said, community and connection is made.
So this is going to sound really, what's the right word for that? I don't want, like, almost dismissive. Yeah, it's probably going to come across as rude. Let's do it anyway. Because, I mean, and so I was one class away from having a minor in religion, so I got to explore a lot of different religions and certain religions more deeply. And part of that was we got to go to different temples. I went to a Reform Jewish synagogue, and I got to see a naming ceremony that day. But what I remember, like, that was most fun and interesting for me as a non-Jew was the food after. That's what I was gonna say. It's totally not cool. Anyway, I'm so like not PC. So there was the food. And I mean, because I didn't have, I mean, they carried the Torah and things like that. And I understand the significance of it. But for me as a non-Jew, I don't have the same feelings towards it. So for me, it was the afterwards, everybody getting together and this wonderful food spread and everybody celebrating food and these children and things like that. And similarly, I went to a Sikh temple. And of course, I didn't understand a word of what was going on. I was there to watch and participate, and I sat in the back. And then they had this amazing lunch after. So it was, you know, that, and to me, it's that sense of communities. I think to be part of a religion, or even just part of, let's say, a religious community, you don't necessarily have to believe in everything. You're often going for that sense of belonging and that sense of community and the shared food and the things like that. I'm not trying to minimize it. That's what I'm trying to say. Like, I'm not trying to minimize it or make light of it or anything like that. But to me, it's part of it. And I think a lot of people, when they leave religion, they miss that part. They don't necessarily miss the ceremony part, but they miss the community and the eating together and that kind of
contact. Yeah, definitely. Well,
and joy.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, it's not rude at all, because I think there's a lot of Jewish people that feel the same way about the food. And sometimes they think they're more culturally Jewish than kind of like the traditional religious aspect of it. And now I lost my thought of what I was going to say beyond that. Oh, okay. Now I remember. So, like, I think that's so key, like thinking about like the community aspect of it, because when we become adults, like, where do we find community? Like, it's hard, you know, being autistic and developing like relationships and stuff. Where do we look for that? Well, employment. We know what employment is for us, right? It could be a very challenging aspect. And that's kind of like the main place where people develop those relationships as an adult. So if we're kind of taking the religious building, going to, and, you know, kind of losing our community, taking that out of our lives, then like, where are we finding that community?
I think that's something that a lot of atheists struggle with, where they try to have a community without having the religious part. Yeah, I wasn't raised with any particular religion. And I say that kind of loosely in the sense that I was christened as Anglican, Protestant, but I was never confirmed. We didn't go to church every Sunday. I certainly didn't know. I still don't know a lot of how things work. I'm there fumbling in the back. I was at a funeral actually just last week, and I know how to say the Lord's Prayer by heart. And I look at what other people are doing, and I cross myself when everybody else does and go through the motions. But I don't have any pull towards it. I don't have any strong beliefs towards it. But I guess kind of like that's very much like autistic masking, right? I go in, I do the socially accepted thing. I know what I'm supposed to do in that case, but there's no feeling behind it. And it's an act. It feels like an act. It is an act. I mean, I can cross myself and it doesn't,
yeah,
doesn't do anything for me, right?
So. Yeah, I definitely can relate. Like, there were some things I had some feelings towards, like felt it, like, you know, going into temples. But then I think, you know, there was other things that were part of these ceremonies still today that, and this is, I think, a very autistic thing, is why? Like, why are we, you know, like, why are we doing this thing that, you know, like, why does this have to be part of the ceremony? I remember as a kid asking these things to rabbis and somewhat getting in trouble for asking those questions, as I continue today, just to ask questions, because I don't understand a lot about this world, and I want to learn from people about, like, well, why, you know?
Too many questions,
Too many questions. Well, who knew this? So much of this was going to turn into a religious conversation. I didn't anticipate that, but... You know,
it's interesting because it's part of the identity. It's, yeah.
Yeah.
we still never finished answering the question about how this affected our artistic identity.
Yeah, I guess we didn't. I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm so, for me, like, I guess it's the identity that I feel most connected with, my autistic identity. I feel much more at home talking with autistic people than non-autistic people. I feel like learning about my autism, and someone said this a long time ago, so this is not an original thought. It's just an aspect of better understanding who you are and how your brain works. So I love learning, and I'm still trying to learn how my brain works. So I guess I feel like, at least for me, it's the most meaningful identity to myself. Well, I guess, is it more than like being a spouse? I don't know about that. Maybe I should go back a little bit. Hopefully, my spouse doesn't listen to this episode, Kelly. I do love being, I love being married, although I never thought I would do that. I love being a son. I love being a brother. I love being an uncle. Those types of identities are really important to me as well.
So I think it's interesting, like when you put your autistic identity first, I'm trying to think if, I mean, it is, so for me, it is the lens that I see everything through. In terms of connecting with others, I would say that there's not like I can't qualitatively measure like what is more connecting. So I know that like for sure when I speak to other autistic people, like 99% of the time we get on like a house on fire. Although houses aren't supposed to be fire. That is like a really strange expression. Why do we say that? Why do we say that? Anyway, we get along really well. However, when I'm in community with other Black people, I also feel connected and I feel like I'm understood. When I look at aspects of French Canadian culture, I feel a connection and I might feel like I understand and that I'm part of it. I'm not necessarily welcomed that way, but it doesn't mean that I don't feel the connection to it. I think that's kind of where the difference is in that sense. I would say that me being accepted or seen as Québécoise is on the level, in the terms of like the way that they don't see me, the way that I am unseen, is very similar to me being not seen or accepted by neurotypicals as an autistic person. That's, I think, maybe it's a loose analogy, but it's probably a pretty apt one. The kind of, oh, well, you don't look autistic. And I've gotten that, oh, well, you don't look Quebecois, right? Or you don't speak the same way I do. Or where like I grew up with a mix of both cultures, like no problem. And that's the thing. My mom, again, my white mom, credit to her, had no problem sharing not just her culture and my father's culture. There was never like a battle. There was never like, oh, you have to do one or the other. I ate both traditional foods from both sides of the family. It's more an issue from outsiders not accepting me because of the color of my skin. So yeah, it's very interesting. It's very interesting how we can live with that and reconcile those things at the same time.
Something else that kind of came up on the episode with Kayla, which for whatever reason, I really enjoy talking about this subject, probably because I still have some work to do, is internalized ableism, where Kayla kind of talked about that. And we talked a little bit about honoring our limitations, in thinking about in those things. So, how do you see, like, honoring your limitations and internalized ableism, where's the connection for you?
I would say it took me a long, not to, it didn't take me a long time to accept my autism or even my hearing loss, which came later. It took me a long time to, I think, honor and respect it in the sense of, yes, there's limitations, but it gives me amazing strengths. Like I have amazing skills and talents because of it. And I was always kind of told as a child, especially in the education system, to turn that down, to kind of tune it down. Oh, okay, Kelly, that's, you know it. We know you know it. So stop raising your hand. You don't have to give other kids a chance to answer the question. We know you're smart, Kelly. So tune it down. And so those are the messages I had to even up to CJ, which is for us, it's after high school. Teachers telling me, okay, well, yeah, you can shut up now. Like, stop answering the questions because you're too smart. And so it took me a long time to embrace that. So it's not that I didn't know I was intelligent, but because of the messages I was told, well, you can't shine too brightly. Don't show it off. When I wasn't, when that's the thing, the feeling behind that, the sentiment behind that was, I was proud I knew the answer. I was happy that I had done the research and that I had these facts in my head. And I was shamed. I wasn't allowed to be proud of those things. And so when it came to the workplace, it was very much like, well, I've got to just kind of keep my head down and do it. But you can't do it too well, because that was my experience. I had coworkers who got jealous. Well, she did that really fast. How'd she do that so fast? She must be doing something, must be cheating. She must be taking some shortcuts somewhere. Like, how, you know, well, she thinks she's better than us then. Well, no, I just happened to do it fast. There's nothing else other than I just did it quickly. And I'm not thinking about you when I'm doing it quickly. I'm thinking about doing my work. And maybe if you all focused on your work and stopped focusing on me, you would get it done as fast. But anyways. And so, yeah, so even as like as a business owner, when I went out on my own, I had to accept the fact that, respect the fact that I work quickly in certain situations where I set myself up for success, and that isn't going to look like how other people run their business. And if I try to force myself to look like how other people run their businesses, I will become demotivated and it will make me want to curl up and die. I mean, honestly. And I don't need to put on a show and a song and dance for some other project manager at a company so that I can prove to them that I'm doing it however way they want it. No, if you want to work with me, you're going to work with me the way that I work best. And that's how you're going to get the best work back. So let me do my thing my way.
Well, first off, I want to say that I would have loved being in class with you, because I loved in classes where students would raise their hand to answer the question, because I was always so scared to speak in class. So I would have been so thrilled to have you as a classmate. It would have been wonderful. I think the second thing is, and I didn't know it back then and didn't have the language to understand, but just processing those questions kind of takes me a longer time. So those types of things were always very difficult for me. So, and if someone does something better than you, I don't understand that. What's wrong with acknowledging that? You're better at speaking than me, Kelly. Okay, so what? Okay, let's move on. You have a skill that's, you know, like, we all have different skills, right? Like, what's the problem with saying that this person has a skill or it is more advanced in that skill than I am?
Like, I don't fix computer wires. So even me saying that shows how much I don't know. Like, all those wires behind the stereo and the TV, my partner does that. Because I'm sorry, it makes no sense to me. And I don't, you know, red to red, I don't care. Like, I don't even know what it's doing or why it has to do that, or HDMI to what, I don't know. So I can't do that. I mean, not that I can't. I could probably learn if I wanted to. I don't. I have somebody that does that for me. And that's okay, right? That's his strength. That's not my strength. So let's just, yeah.
Well, I think I don't know if part of it is this, but for me, like, when, like, you get, like, these instruction manuals, it's so difficult to, like, understand what's going on in these manuals. The pictures are terrible. I appreciate that they attempt with pictures, but they're terrible usually. So we need some autistic people designing at least the visual aspect of these instruction manuals a lot more. So there's that. And then I think just the written instructions are not specific enough for me. Like, it's like hard for me to like process the whole thing. I eventually get it and I can usually put the thing together, but it takes a lot more time in my life than I wish that it didn't, you know, like, if those instruction booklets were better, I think it would be a lot easier to do.
There's some people who are masters at that. There's actually an autistic guy in, I think, Alberta who,
yeah,
people pay him. He puts together specifically IKEA furniture. He is the master at IKEA furniture, and he doesn't do like anything else. That's what he does. You call him, he goes in, he puts together your like shelf for you.
Mm-hmm.
And he does it, he does it quickly as well. He does it, he's efficient. He knows what he's doing.
Yeah. I can't remember his name off the top of my head now. I know who you're talking about, though.
Oh, you're looking? Okay, yeah.
Yes, there it is. Brad Fremerlin, yes. Something by Brad.
Wow.
The website I can't remember. Something it's something by Brad. Yeah, built by Brad or something.
Okay. Nice. Like built by Brad. Yeah, that makes sense.
So something, yeah, something
So
like.
if you're in his area, in his town, can call him up and have him put together your stuff.
I think he comes to your home, right, and and puts together your stuff. So I kind of have a story relating to this that actually happened yesterday. So I was invited to a graduation party, and I was very happy to go, happy to see this young man graduate. I've known him since middle school and seen him grow and mature and all those things. And I've learned enough about myself, like I can't be at a party very long. So I said, I'm only going to be there like an hour and a half at the most, and then I'm going to leave. And, and I stuck to that. But as I was going along, there were new people, which are stressful, certainly. You never know what to expect. And, if it was a new party with autistic people, I think I could probably have stayed a lot longer. But there were, I think, a lot of non-autistic people, or at least maybe people that might not know that they're neurodivergent and are kind of indoctrinated in neurotypical culture. And just those conversations were just like, I could feel like the energy drain from me in having these conversations versus our conversation just now, right now. Like I could talk for many hours with you. We won't, don't worry, Kelly, we won't do that. But so just like, yeah, just, or just, typically the interviews that we do, like I could just kind of like go on and we don't, just respecting our guests' time and your time, like don't want to go on for 3 hours there. But I just like left this party yesterday. I don't know how I even drove home. It was like a 20-minute drive or something. I was just so exhausted. And when I got home, I felt like I was like a zombie. I went to sleep at like 7:30 p.m. last night, and God, I must have slept for like 11 hours or so. Which I don't do anymore at all. Like just always, it feels like it's always like a constant like reevaluation. I'm recalibrating what my kind of limitations are with things.
I think about like how I kind of psych myself up for things. Like going back to the funeral, like I kind of, again, I left the my home, but like it was kind of last minute, obviously, for a funeral. And I had to get up really early in the morning, like at like 3 a.m. so I can get this flight and go out. And I had like a rip-roaring headache by the time I landed because I was tired and I can't eat properly, really. There's no these planes. Anyways, Canadian planes, no food. And then I kind of kept pushing through anyway because there's things I wanted to get done and there's things that I wanted to do, like personally. It wasn't just about the funeral and I didn't want to make it just about the funeral and stuff. Anyway, just all that to say, like I knew ahead of time that it was going to be a lot. So I knew that I had kind of planned in time for myself alone as well. And then it kind of also accepting that it is going to be awkward no matter what, right? I was going to a funeral from an ex-coworker. We weren't 100% that close, but I still care. And I ended up at the reception after with all his family. I was literally the only person that was not family, and I was the only person there that was not only family, but like from out of town, like not anywhere. It's not like I showed up and they had a picnic before or something and I'd seen them. It's going to be awkward. And then I don't do well in groups. And then it's after a funeral. How do you start a conversation? Do you go up to somebody and be like, "Hey, how was your vacation lately?" Like somebody just died. So I mean, I'm not going to go up and be like, "Hey, how do you know the person that died?" Like that's just like, it's not like, how do you make small talk? So yeah, it was totally awkward. I ate, I talked to a few people, I sat for a bit, I talked to my coworker, but I felt like I did what I did respectfully what I could do, and then I left at a reasonable time. And so I left before some other people did, but that's okay. I was still there. And for me, I think my presence was more important than my feelings of awkwardness. So yeah, I balance it out. I kind of prepare myself ahead of time.
That's the same. That was my same feeling yesterday going to this graduation party. Like, I knew this is probably not going to be an environment that I'm going to be super excited to be in, but kind of owed it to the person that was graduating. And yeah, small talk, I think for me is like, I need connection, and I always need to have meaningful conversations with people. I think that's why podcasting and asking people questions on these podcasts is so meaningful to me, because I think it's an opportunity to connect, to learn, to share. And I think a lot of times in these situations, like how do you connect at a funeral? Like, oh, that's kind of a tricky situation, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not like a wedding, right? Like a wedding, you can be like, oh, how do you know the couple? That's fine. But like, yeah, at a funeral, what the hell do you do?
Context. Context is so difficult.
But I think that's actually the fun part about the podcast. I think our podcast represents like autistic communication authentically, in the sense that we just dive right in, right? We don't spend a lot of time kind of like being like, oh, so how's the weather where you are? And I wouldn't listen to a podcast that did stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
It's just not my personality. So yeah, we just dive right into the juicy, meaty everything and go for it. And that's how we communicate in general. So
absolutely. It's definitely autistic communication. So last thing, unless there's something else you wanted to get to, I did want to ask you about, in terms of communication, it seems like you've been doing a lot of virtual speaking engagements, a lot of in-person engagements recently. Like, seems kind of, I don't know how many you're doing, but it seems like a lot. Seems like it might be overwhelming. What's been that experience like recently?
So, you know, I was giving talks and stuff before the pandemic, and then with the pandemic, it shifted to virtual. And what I noticed when I went back to in person was that I forgot how to breathe. I know it sounds super strange.
No, not at all.
Like, I would find myself out of breath giving a talk, and like suddenly realize, oh, I'm getting kind of dizzy. I'm kind of lightheaded. I'm okay. I'm burping, so I'm swallowing air. Like, what the hell? And I'm like, you know, I came back from some of the first like in-person ones I've done. I said, what the hell is going on? Like, how can I not talk anymore? Like, this is what I do all the time. And so people are like, well, are you nervous? And I said, no, I don't get nervous. Like, this energizes me. I have a great time getting up and speaking. Anyway, it turns out I was just probably speaking too fast. Probably, I get so excited and passionate. Like, forget that, you know, I'm breathing too shallow. I'm not breathing deep enough. And so I'm actually running out of air while speaking, because I'm just like, so, I think I was just like so excited to be back on stage. And so, yeah, it was uncomfortable, right? Those first couple ones became very uncomfortable. And I was actually like almost in physical pain afterwards, because I hadn't been breathing and stuff. And it took quite some recovery time. So it's like, there was a little bit of fear of like, okay, is this going to happen every time I talk? Because this is one of the most important parts of my business, in my opinion. But, you know, I figured it out. And what I've done is I've also integrated my breathing, or my need to remember to breathe, into my talk. And I invite the audience to kind of take a deep breath with me. And that helps to slow me down and help to remind me, so that I don't end up in pain at the end of my talk.
I didn't think we'd be talking about breathing when I asked you this question, but I love that, because, you know, not that maybe about in the last 6 months, I learned that the majority of us humans, it's like over 90%, we don't know how to breathe correctly. We have inverted breathing patterns. So, you know, I've learned recently how to breathe correctly, and that's definitely been really helpful. But also just reminding myself to breathe throughout the day is, you know, the kind of the executive functioning of it has also, you know, I think is really important. We so often don't remember to breathe. So I love that you're encouraging the audience to do that as well.
Yeah, because we're up here, you can actually cause yourself a panic attack because you get all tight. And part of that integration, or that reminder to have my audience breathe along with me, was taught to me when I was doing another validation program, a learning program. And we're talking about how you have to be regulated in order to learn, to assimilate information. And so I kind of use that as saying, well, I'm speaking at you a lot. I'm telling you a lot of things. You're learning a lot of new things, some things that might even be uncomfortable for you to learn. And so I invite people to breathe with me just to take a pause and to kind of digest that information, like really breathe it in, so to speak, right? But it helps them, I think. It helps me. It helps them be more open to what I'm saying. Again, especially if they find it confrontational, if they find it that it's headbutting with ideas or opinions that they had, causing a little bit of an internal conflict. It can be good to step back a moment, breathe, and you're not in trouble. No one's going to get hurt. No, it's not in danger. We're just learning some new things today. It's going to be okay.
What's been like the feedback of your kind of recent talks, and like, how's that been going for you?
So, I mean, I've had some great feedback in the sense of like how I do it, how I make the presentations accessible. I use simple language. I use simple examples. I use myself an example. I'm vulnerable. I'm open. And I think my brain just moves so fast that's thinking and speaking on the fly works for me. And because I'm not nervous, I'm not like, if there is silence, if I am thinking, I don't care. Like, it doesn't bother me. And I think that can be refreshing for an audience as well, to not have somebody just blah, 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 at lightning speed. But I mean, I think my big issue is, even when people are receptive to it, I don't see a lot of changes happening. Or at least, you know, as usual, change makers, we don't see it as fast as we want it. We don't see things going as quickly as we want it. I see a lot of lip service still in terms of companies working on inclusion, or even just the concept of neurodiversity and anything to do with diversity in general. A lot of talk, but no action, or no concrete actions, or no sustainable actions. Yeah, there's a lot. I don't want to put down any businesses' efforts, especially the ones I've worked with. Like, I don't want to put down their efforts for the steps they have taken, and a lot of them are doing the best they can as quickly as they can in terms of their own environment and their own culture. But there's a lot still that needs to be done. And I think that is intimidating for a lot of businesses, especially.
Yeah. You feel like they're anxious about, do you feel like they're anxious about making the wrong steps? Or is this more, or is there also some amount of, this is just like checking a box to some degree?
I'd say there's a mixture in terms of the misunderstanding of the importance of it first. So that awareness piece, or not understanding really what it is or what it actually entails. And then there's a fear of getting it wrong. But there's also, I think, a concern of, well, we've done this, you know, we've done gender equity, we've done the 2S LGBTQ, we're so tired, it's never going to end. And it's like, well, yeah, as long as there are people, it is never going to end. As long as there are different people on this earth, it's never going to end. And that's not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing. It's not bad to learn how to live with different people. Like, it shouldn't seem as like this labor, like this horrible thing that we have to do as a business or something. It should just be part of your natural reality, because that is the world. I mean, unless you put yourself in a bubble somewhere, you're going to interact with people, and you should interact with people. You should interact with different people, and there's nothing wrong with doing that. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, just continuous growth, right? Keep on, yeah. Well,
there's a lot of fear. Yeah,
definitely. All right. Well, was there anything else you wanted to talk about today, or should we wrap this thing up?
We could wrap this one up and we can keep talking for another episode later.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I was a little nervous about this episode, but once we both showed up wearing the same color somehow, I knew this was going to be a great episode. So thanks as always, Kelly. And I guess stay tuned. Next time we come back, we're going to have another wonderful guest.
Excellent. Thank you.